It's Wednesday, November 18th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Jamie Gray. On our program this week, more on Mizzou in the national spotlight, from editorials and columns across the country to a political cartoon in The New Yorker. We'll talk about Charlie Sheen's appearance on the Today Show yesterday, in which he announced his HIV status in what sounded like an attempt to stave off blackmailers. And we'll talk about a move by the Swiss Foundation that owns the copyright to the Diary of Anne Frank, adding her father, Otto, as a co-author to keep the text from entering the public domain. There's a lot more, hopefully, that we'll get to as well, but let's go back to Friday afternoon at about the same time we learned here in mid-Missouri of Gary Pinkel's diagnosis of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and his impending retirement. Terror rained down on Paris, a series of calculated suicide bombings that left more than 120 dead and put the world on watch. There are a number of angles I want to pursue here, but let's start with the speed with which the media turned to cover the story, sending correspondents to Paris in what seemed like lightning time.
Mm-hmm. You did see that. I mean, immediately you had the national media mobilizing, and also we had some local reporters that were also mobilized incredibly quickly to get there, because I think it was obvious very early on that this was going to be a big story with global impact.
Yeah, and I think you also had the situation where it's the biggest terrorist attack, you know, in several years. And you get the impression that since it was going to be a weekend, this is going to be a big story, because you couldn't have Prison Watch on MSNBC or all the kind of stuff you were going to have on a weekend with a big story like that. You had to throw all your resources in.
Jamie, how much of it do you think to the fact that we're in a sweeps period, that may have driven some of the decision making on the local affiliate level to send staffers overseas?
Sure. I mean, when you're in a ratings period, sometimes that does drive your coverage decisions, and particularly when you're talking about the amount of money that it would take to deploy certain resources. Sometimes there is money that you will make more readily available during a sweeps period because it is an important thing for television stations. That being said, I hesitate to say that that would be the only driver, and I would hope that that wouldn't be the only driver here.
I'd have to say, too, that I was glad to see the media jump on the story, but I was also glad to see a little bit of restraint. I was actually driving home at the time that the story broke, and I was tuning in my radio for different things and landed on the BBC, and they were doing an admirable job on a story that was much closer to home for them than some other folks, and they were not speculating. They were being very careful in talking to their reporters early on and exactly what they could say and what they couldn't say. That changed, obviously, within a few hours, but I thought that was good on their part to try to be careful about what they said and not get into all kinds of rank speculation about it.
Have there been any pieces or any moments over the course of the last few days that have stood out especially strongly for either of you?
I'll point out a few that my students actually brought to my attention. I had seen some of them in class this week. And these were online examples that I thought were really good. The Guardian had just this fabulous video that basically described, without any narration, without any reporters or anchors involved in it, typical online production piece with a lot of user-generated content, you know, cell phone video and that sort of thing. And it really summed up that story in about a minute and a half in ways that other people couldn't. Another video I thought that was really great from the New York Times, they simply put they managed to find a young person who had escaped from the Bataclan, from the theater where the concert was, and he'd been shot, but other people had dragged him out. They set him in front of a camera, and he just told his story in French with subtitles, but it was so engrossing. I mean, everyone in the class, certainly I imagine most millennials who could empathize with that story, were just fascinated by it.
Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, sometimes I'm really critical of the sites that aggregate content, particularly from social media, from those first person accounts that you'll see pulling from Twitter, pulling from all these things. But in this particular case, I think we saw some really good examples of social media content being aggregated in a good way that allowed you to really see real time what was going on, real time the fear, real time what people were doing in reaction, and be able to, as an audience, distill that and be able to truly understand what was going on the other side of the globe.
Well, I know we have students studying in Paris this semester, and they're all accounted for, but until that could be done, there was a lot of worry and fear for their safety. Imagine being on the job, reporting on what's happening, knowing that your daughter is there. That was the case for Geraldo Rivera. His daughter, Simone, was at the soccer game with friends at the time of the attacks. Here's what he said on the air describing that.
It's terrible. Here she is. This is my gorgeous daughter, right? It's very upsetting. I'm used to being in the action myself. I can't. It's a lot easier to report these things and to experience them myself than if it is your child. She just turned 21 years old. She's a straight A student. She's a wonderful, wonderful person, and very gentle soul. And we're obviously very concerned.
His daughter is okay, and we know that's because their emotional reunion happened in front of Fox News cameras.
I knew that Simone was okay. We had spoken on the phone, we had texted, we had emailed, but there's nothing like that first moment where you see your child and can hug them and to reassure yourself that all is well, that she's okay.
I can't imagine what it's like to be that parent in the first clip when you're having that very fearful emotional response.
And I have to say, I mean, Geraldo is Geraldo and people will make fun of him, but that was very real, I think. And should the story have been about him? I don't know. I mean, if you had a correspondent who was in your shop who had that experience, wouldn't you put them on the air? I think so. It was a lot more calculated with the reunion, and I think that I have a different reaction to that. But it was very real what we saw at first.
And I agree with that. This wasn't taking an opportunity of you have a correspondent or a host that has a kid that happens to be in Paris. This was someone who was actually at the soccer arena that mm-hmm. night. And right. So there's a little bit of a different perspective there. You're not just saying, oh, I've got someone that I know who's in Paris, because I would venture to say a lot of people have that particular experience. So this is a little bit different. But yeah, that reunion, it felt a little bit more, not staged, but I guess, orchestrated. And not only that, you know, we can all be happy that she is okay. But at the same time, when that was happening, we were finally seeing the photos of the victims who had died and been severely injured and finally learning those stories. And so it felt like it may have taken away a bit from those stories that were also being told.
And there were two other American students there mm-hmm. who did die in those attacks. So it does, at least in my opinion, it takes away a little bit as we're starting to hear and learn who those people are to see this reporter's very mm-hmm. happy, mm-hmm. smile-filled reunion. Mike, you had said you personally had some other thoughts about how that was on TV.
Well, so actually, I was going to say a little bit about another personality mm-hmm. who was on the air. I mean, you mentioned on our Links blog, Stephen Colbert, mm-hmm. but I was also interested in how Bill Maher, the comedian, mm-hmm. responded to this. You know, he has his own show on HBO called Real Time, and he's also a prominent atheist. And when he started his show, he expressed his sympathy for, obviously, the victims in Paris. But then he had on as his first guest a Muslim feminist, Azra Nomani, and they spent, I don't know, 5 or 6 minutes talking about his belief that he gets attacked on social media quite a bit, that there is an obligation for liberals politically in this country and moderate Muslims to say something and to be more out front about condemning this kind of behavior. Now, I don't want to get into the argument of whether or not he's right, but I think it's an interesting perspective that he was willing to share on the air at a time when probably most people wouldn't have.
And his show was taped Friday night around 7:15 Los Angeles time. And so this was mere hours right. after this news was breaking, after the terrorist attacks had been carried out.
So in that those overnight hours in France. Another interesting player, as this all came together on the media side, was Facebook launching the safety mm-hmm. check feature. How does that work exactly?
I actually had a friend who used it who was in Paris. And so basically you could check in Facebook that you were safe once Facebook turned on that function. Mm-hmm. And you'd see in your feed from your friends that I'm in Paris, I'm okay. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people I know said that they had somebody they knew who also used that feature. Mm-hmm. It's really great. And they've also used it at times of natural disaster, earthquakes, and other things. but they didn't use it the day before when more than 40 people died in Beirut from a terrorist bombing.
Another thing Facebook put into effect that also not available during the Beirut bombing was the filter that you can put over your profile picture. I'm sure if you were to log on to Facebook right now, you would still see a lot of your Facebook friends having the blue, white, and red French flag filtered over it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That too also.
I think Facebook is trying to figure out where to go with how its role in worldwide disasters and attacks, what their role is going to be. Right. And so I think in this case, you know, they tried something out a little bit different than they had done in the past. And were they going to get criticism? Yes, absolutely. But I think that Facebook has also come out and said, now we're looking at doing this more often. And I think it's an evolving thing. And that's so much of what we talk about here is how is technology evolving to disseminate information? And what will that mean for us going forward? And so I anticipate that we would probably see more of this and that Facebook will become even more engaged with the audience, especially during times where they can help. I mean, the idea of Facebook is to connect people. And so this is the type of service that Facebook can provide.
When Facebook was criticized, and I mean, I think that's fair, and though Mark Zuckerberg did react, as you said, I think there was also, by extension, a lot of criticism of the media generally for not covering a terrorist attack in Beirut the same way they would in the West, quote unquote.
Well, but that also begs the question, because this came up in some circles too, did the media not cover it? Or because so many people have become conditioned to consume news based on what shows up in their social feeds, that if people that they're connected to aren't sharing it, that they're not as exposed to it as if they sought out news independently from news sources.
I think that might be part of the explanation, but I'm afraid the other part of the explanation is that even if the media covered that story, there are a lot of Americans generally who just don't care as much if something happens in Arab countries as if it happens in the West.
And I think part of that is that a lot of Americans have been to Paris and have a connection with France, whether it's, you know, having gone on vacation there or studied abroad there and those types of things that you won't have in some of the Middle East Arab countries. Does that mean that that should dictate our coverage? I think that's a different conversation. And I think that conversation is happening right now because of the proximity of those two events.
Okay. Well, last week, speaking of proximity, big news here on campus not only made headlines in the news sections, but also on the opinion pages. It was even the subject of a New Yorker cartoon last Thursday, the frame showing protesters marching in front of Jesse Hall coming upon a man holding a coffee cup. The caption, "Not getting Christmassy enough? Christmas cups does not mean you understand discrimination." That, of course, being a reference to the controversy over the season's red cups at Starbucks. The commentary there being, though, that there are real people with real problems and we're worrying about the color of Starbucks cups.
You know, I mean, that was funny, and it is a certain sort of critique from the left. But I have to say, the more damaging critiques in terms of the university's reputation.
And there have been several this week, among them some polls that are showing that perhaps the university and people here that our reputation, among others statewide, is not what it once was. Lieutenant Governor Kinder making some comments as well.
Yeah, I mean, Lieutenant Governor Kinder, who's running for governor, basically said that the protesters were pampered by radical tenured professors. And, you know, I mean, you're going to hear a lot more of that. And even though other members of the legislature weren't saying that, a lot of them were thinking it. And that's a problem. I mean, I don't mean to reduce this story to how the university does damage control, because there are a lot of very serious and ongoing issues that we've talked about. But damage control was certainly foremost in the minds of a lot of administrators. They were putting out talking points this week about what to say, because they're being deans and faculty members and administrators at higher levels in the university are being bombarded with telephone calls from parents, from donors, from just angry constituents. And most of it is very negative.
Well, and I can guarantee you that right now, enrollment management types on this campus are figuring out, what is the image of Mizzou going to be, not only in the state of Missouri, but also nationwide and worldwide? And how are we going to portray this campus as an inclusive, accepting place? And that's a layer that's going on beyond what is actually being done change-wise on campus. But I would imagine that they are working on some brochures, some literature that would target particularly Black African-American potential students and also the families of those students that we have on campus right now. After the Sasha Manu Corey story came out and questioning lots of issues surrounding Title IX, I know that that was an issue that enrollment management types were looking at from the standpoint of an institution that needs to look at its image. And so no doubt those conversations are happening.
There was also a piece in the Tribune yesterday afternoon about how this also becomes an economic development issue for the city and how discussions surrounding new student housing complex are now being kind of put on hold or curbed a little bit because there's the concern about what could happen with enrollment and whether or not there will remain the need for the additional beds to fill them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very easy to over-respond to this kind of content in the spur of the moment, but there is the potential for parents to pull their students mm-hmm. or to not send their students here. There is a potential for donors.
Or for students to choose to leave on their own.
To leave on their
own. Even without parental involvement.
Or for donors to decide not to give or to withdraw money that they're giving to the university. Or for the legislature to decide to penalize us and not, you know, appropriate as much money as in the past because of their perception that the university didn't handle the situation very well. So there is, I mean, you're right, there are a lot of folks in enrollment management, but they're not the only ones. The entire mm-hmm. sort of communication structure on campus. Campus is putting out talking points to people. I mean, how to answer questions like, is MU restricting free speech? When would you have expected somebody to ask that question prior to this week? And there's even a whole section about what do you say if somebody asks you any kind of question about the former president, Tim Wolf? And the answer in this sort of prepared talking points is Mr. Wolf's spokesman is John Fugere. Here's his phone number. Give him a call. Mm-hmm. So they are thinking very carefully about how to manage that message.
Well, I think in addition to the talking points, though, the things that kind of there's usually some sort of line, especially when it comes to faculty with academic freedom. Mm-hmm. Here's the school's line on this. But as always, you have the freedom to be able to express your own beliefs right. about what's going on campus. And we have seen those lines put out as well.
Last spring, the documentary The Hunting Ground screened at Ragtag. Fresh off the Sundance Film Festival, it takes a hard look at the issue of sexual assault on college campuses.
The first few weeks, I made some of my best friends, but two of us were sexually assaulted before classes had even started.
I went to the dean of students' office, and she said, I just want to make sure that you don't talk to anyone about this.
They protect perpetrators because they have a financial incentive to do so.
The problem of sexual assault on campuses is enormous.
I think it's fair to say that they cover these crimes up.
There's a lot of victim blaming.
He lectured us about how we shouldn't go out in short skirts.
They told me, despite the fact that I had a written admission of guilt, that what I presented to them could only prove that he loved me.
Well, I haven't seen it yet. I'm told it's haunting. And Sunday I'll get my chance when it debuts on CNN. There are some professors at Harvard Law School who have a real problem with this. What's their argument?
Well, they're taking one of the four featured women in the document, and I haven't seen it either, by the way. I'm only going by what's been written about it. They take one of the women who was featured in it, and they basically, a reporter for Slate debunked basically her entire story, saying that the young law school student who she accused of raping her and her friend was kicked out of school for 4 years while his case was basically being investigated and adjudicated, that even though in the film she says the university didn't care, the university claims that they did investigate it and that they found and that a court found that he was not guilty of any felony charges, and yet the documentary doesn't include any of that or his perspective. Now, does a documentary have to include the perspectives of all parties involved as we would if we did a story on KOMU or a television network? They don't have to. I mean, that's what makes a documentary form different.
And that's the counter argument that we're getting from a student's advocacy mm-hmm. group on campus at Harvard.
Right. And I mean, there's this advocacy journalism or advocacy documentaries. And we see a lot of these coming out and then will spark a lot of different criticisms when those happen. But do they have to include both sides? Like you said, not necessarily. I mean, I have a general rule with my students and for myself, you don't name anybody without giving them the opportunity to speak. But documentaries, do they have to? Not necessarily. But there are also still standards, and you can also be sued for defamation with a documentary, and it has happened to some people who have made documentary films. So, you know, I'll be interested to see it because, of course, you know, in the promo, we can't exactly tell. There are a couple of lines in there where I thought, I wonder what that's going to be. Particularly, they mention one particular fraternity in the trailer. And so I wonder, you know, how is that all going to come out in the full-length documentary? And I think that's when I'll be able to form a better opinion.
Yeah, obviously, we all need to see it. I have a couple of questions about it based on just the reporting that's been done. I mean, one, sure, documentarians, they have a different role than traditional journalists do. But traditional journalists certainly have the right to say, if you didn't cover this story fairly, you didn't include all the information, or you distorted the information that was in the public record, it's our right to call that out, and we should. And the other part of it is that I worry that, kind of like the story from Rolling Stone about the University of Virginia, that these journalists are doing a disservice to the trying to deal with the problem of sexual assault on campus by giving people excuses to call into question that it is a problem.
And I think in particular, that is the climate under which this particular documentary is going to be examined, is because of the Rolling Stone article. And then you're kind of walking into some dangerous territory there with how you are going to report and how sexual assault victims are going to tell their stories, and if they're going to tell their stories, not only for pieces of journalism, but also in reporting to police.
Creating a chilling effect on multiple levels.
You also mentioned, Amy, and I think it bears repeating, so most people, if they're going to see this, are going to see it on CNN. I mean, that's the value of having that platform. But CNN is also going to be airing a special live segment after the airing of the documentary.
As they did with Blackfish.
And it's going to be interesting to see if any of these particular issues come up.
Well, so our next topic, when I first saw it, my first thought was, well, that's kind of cool. Then I did some more reading, and I saw it's far more complicated than I originally thought. The Swiss Foundation that owns the copyright to the diary of Anne Frank, it's added her father, Otto Frank, as an official author to the book. Here's why. In Europe, copyrights expire 70 years after an author dies. Anne Frank died 70 years ago in Bergen-Belsen. Her father, who did write the book's foreword, died in 1980. By adding him, the foundation holds on to its rights to that text until the end of the year 2050. The foundation indicated its intent to do this better part of a year ago, and now that we're just weeks away from that expiration, now we're hearing the outrage.
Right. And I think there's a couple of things here. I mean, one with copyright law. Copyright laws have changed and adapted to certain events. And here in the United States, most would say that it's Walt Disney and kind of the Mickey Mouse effect, because there's a definite curve. You can see that copyright law gets extended just about the time Mickey Mouse is about to come up. And so, and that's the law that's currently in place. Here, it would be in 2047 that the Anne Frank copyright would expire 95 years after the first publication. So I think looking at that, it's, you know, there was an intent to have copyright expire at some point and for things to go into the public domain. And there are some ideas with Anne Frank's work to put up this big online kind of interactive new way to look at Anne Frank's diary, and really kind of a more immersive way to look at it. And I think that would be a positive thing. But then you also have to look at, in this case, which is different than the Walt Disney case, is the money that they are generating is being donated to
educational and Yom HaShoah and Shoah causes, looking to not profit off of what Anne Frank and her family went through.
So the motivation is different than in some of these other cases that we look at.
Right. And I kind of think the biggest concern is just the one that Jamie identified. Trying to reach a new generation with the Anne Frank story is going to happen online. It's going to happen through mobile devices. And if you're restricted from being able to tell that story that way, you're going to lose that audience. I do think it's true that you've got a charity that's doing good work that's receiving the money. But there's another charity that's also been fighting with them, you know, at the Anne Frank house. And so it's not as simple a story of good works versus the rights of people to have access to this information.
Okay, well, Don't you love the good exclusive, especially when everyone knows that it's coming? Yesterday morning, it was actor Charlie Sheen on the Today Show with this revelation.
You know there are a lot of rumors
sure.
out there right now, and you would like to address them head on, so I'll give it to you.
Go ahead. I have to, yeah. I'm here to admit that I am, in fact, HIV positive. And I have to put a stop to this onslaught, this barrage of attacks and of sub-truths and very very harmful and mercurial stories that are about that threatening the health of so many others, which couldn't be farther from the truth.
So there's a piece from Time that you can go ahead and read on the Links blog that says it right in the headline. It was uncomfortable television. I don't know about you guys. I watched both segments and it was kind of painful to watch.
It was, a lot of pausing, a lot of like disconnected thoughts, I guess.
But that's Charlie Sheen.
But that's what I was going to say. I mean, in some ways, what we see from him, especially in recent years, is kind of disconnected.
But this was just as much as orchestrated as the Geraldo Rivera reunion. You would almost have expected him to be a little bit more together.
I was going to say, it's ratings fodder and it's clickbait. That's basically what this story is about. I mean, you can't really believe that Charlie Sheen is coming out to try to do more to get people to understand the problems of HIV infections.
He's trying to stave off the blackmailers.
He was, but even in doing that, he basically acknowledged that he had unprotected sex with a couple of women after he got his diagnosis and while he was under the treatment of his doctor. You know, he's opening himself up to some very potentially serious legal problems like Bill Cosby, basically.
And one of those women then went on Howard Stern and talked about how she didn't know until she heard this yesterday or the day before as it started to come out in other publications.
I got to say the entertainment media, too, they're just loving this story. I mean, I saw a promo this morning on KRCG basically saying from Entertainment Tonight, you'll see the softer side of Charlie Sheen, but they're also running these exclusives with these prostitutes and other people that he used to hang out with. So he's going to get it from all directions, I think.
Well, I mean, it's one of those stories that you know people are going to watch and people are going to have opinions on, and then you can post it on Facebook and you'll get a million shares and a million comments of people coming from all sides on this. I think the unfortunate part about this is that in some ways it has shifted the conversation about HIV and AIDS into an area that I'm not so sure is productive. And, you know, it's been a while since we have seen a large scale conversation in the media about HIV AIDS. And so, you know, I think there's an opportunity here to talk about it. But with it being Charlie Sheen and kind of the reputation he has and the polarity of his personality, is that conversation really going to be what comes out of this? Probably not.
I don't think so. And I think, you know, giving his admitted and ongoing drug use and his solicitation of prostitutes, it really doesn't take a great leap of imagination to figure out how he probably contracted the HIV virus. Maybe he's a cautionary tale. That's about the best I think you could expect.
Wow. Okay.
Well, we are just about out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about on our Links blog. That's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. We invite you to like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show. Maya Jackson is our technical director. KBIA's Pat Akers is our audio engineer, and Sule is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. We're going to be taking next week off for the Thanksgiving holiday, but join us again on Wednesday, December 2nd, when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.